This call is not for media representatives or Bank of America Securities investment bankers or commercial bankers, including corporate and commercial FX. All such individuals are instructed to disconnect now. A replay will be available for Bank of America Securities investment bankers and commercial bankers, including corporate and commercial FX. The replay is not available to the media. Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Executive Insights call with CEO and CFO of Joann. Today's call is being recorded. I'd now like to turn the call over to Liz Suzuki. Please go ahead.
Great. Thanks, Christy. Hi, everyone. I'm Liz Suzuki, Senior Hardline Retail Analyst at B of A, and also a Joann customer. I'm a knitter, a kids craft enthusiast, admittedly not a sewer or an owner of a Cricut machine, although I definitely want to learn. So I'm very pleased to be joined by CEO Wade Miquelon and CFO Matt Suze. You guys have had a busy few days, so thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
We're grateful to be here.
Grateful to be here, yes. Thank you.
Great, thanks. So, you know, first, just kind of to set the stage for those on the call who may be generalists or mid-cap PMs or just may not be familiar with the Joann story, can you give an overview of the business, where you're differentiated versus your competitors, and the progress over the company over the last few years that brought you to where you are today?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, Liz. Hopefully this won't be overly verbose, but there's probably a lot to share there. You know, in this industry, you really have kind of three people or three companies that are kind of deeply in it as specialty players. And then you have, lots of people that do convenience plays and what we offer. But in terms of, like, the real meat of the industry, which, arts and crafts or sewing arts and crafts, however you want to define it, it's us, Michaels, and Hobby Lobby. And if you look at the three different companies, we're all kind of in the arts and crafts business, but we have different points of differentiation. Clearly for us, it's a couple things. One, it's the fact that in sewing we're a clear number one, the most in it to win it with about a third share and the potential to keep rolling it up. But also I guess I would say the fact that when you match that plus the broad assortment we have in arts and crafts that we have in seasonal decor, especially in our larger stores and online, that also is something that is very different from anybody else, domestically or anywhere for that matter. Then on the other side of it, you have Hobby Lobby. 50,000 square foot stores. They do very well, and have done very well. But we see them more as a kind of a seasonal and decor company. And they just, really kill it in that front 40% of their store where they're doing wall decor, small furniture, seasonal floral and the like. And that's really their sweet spot. So, for example, a Pier 1 going away. I'm sure they've sucked up an enormous part of that business that really is that customer. And you have Michaels, 18,000 square foot stores, almost all, and they're really an arts and crafts player, kind of to their core. And that's been kind of historically, being the most focused on arts and crafts has kind of been their point of differentiation. And there's, other nuances as we talk today. I'll talk about, the company's been around since Joann since 1943. Started as a sewing company, really grew, did a lot of M&A, did a lot of roll-up over time. And in fact, as we talk about it, that's one of the opportunities for us is we have what we sometimes call snowflakes, 865 stores that range from 7,000 square feet up to, over 50. And a lot of that difference is really been driven kind of throughout the years through M&A. We were a public company until 2011. Matt was around. He's been around 25 years. I've been around five, so he's seen a lot more than I have, certainly. We went private with Leonard Green in 2011. And then probably 5 or 6 years ago is when I would say that we really went on a transformation journey. And I think my predecessor, to her credit, really kind of amped up the game. But anyway, at that point in time, we started bringing in lots of talent, investing heavily in our digital marketing capabilities, our online capabilities. We went on a multi-year journey to really understand, what the store of the future needed to look like, what were the economics of that, how do we do the process right, starting with the customer, who is the who that you have and who do you want and how do you go through that. Really rebranded the brand in aggregate, put in sourcing, direct sourcing capabilities where before we really had none and were completely reliant upon others, and really started raising our game in key areas like merchandising and the assortments that resonate and that go with it. Started to gain some real momentum. I would say we went from kind of, where we'd always generated nice cash flow and EBITDA, but where we were kind of comping around, minus 200 basis points kind of consistently, in part because at that time we had Hobby Lobby building 60 stores a year and Michael's also doing 60. So that was about a 300 to 400 basis point headwind kind of for everybody. That has basically stopped for Michael's, and it's been cut in half and slowing for Hobby Lobby as of the last year. So that's a very good dynamic we see in the business. But, you know, having said that, putting all these capabilities in place, we went to where we started improving comps. We grew EBITDA 3 years in a row, and we comped positive 12 months in a row, growing to 300 basis points higher in some periods. And really, you know, then in the, I guess, September of 2018, as we were kind of building this momentum and really starting to take nice share and grow in growing markets, we got $80 million of tariffs levied against us with the stroke of a pen. And then we had another $50 million on top of that that was announced but never came to pass. So that, I would say, threw us a little bit off of our game. We really spent the next 12 to 15 months doing everything we could to diversify, to try to negotiate away you know, some of this this tariffs. But, you know, if you look at the size of our business, by most metrics, we ended up becoming one of the most tariffed, you know, retailers for sure in the U.S. Just about the time, you know, a year and a half after we were mitigating, we were starting to now see the benefit of some of the mitigation. Of that $80 million, we mitigated, you know, in the end, maybe $35 million away. So as we had been able to mitigate, switch suppliers, see the benefits starting to flow through the P&Ls when the pandemic hit, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, despite all the bad and, you know, the pandemic and being a crisis, I do feel that we've really taken our company to a new heights, and we will so on the fact that, you know, for us, the crisis was really opportunity meeting preparation. You know, yes, there's been, you know, people staying at home and engaging in crafts, and yes, there was a PPE, you know, craze for a while, which is long gone. But the reality is we were able to capture, you know, extraordinary number of new customers, move extraordinary number of new customers into other businesses that we have, gain significant share in some of the segments where we put in capabilities, explode our Omni business, which last year we grew to over $500 million, and we ended up being, we were just awarded the number one fastest growing Omni retailer in the U.S. of over a field of 1,000 last week, and really take the company to a new level. You know, this is the journey, and I know transformation is a word that makes people cringe sometimes because it's often overused, but, you know, the more I think you dive into the things that we've been doing and are doing and will do, I think the more you'll see that that really applies. So, you know, here we are as a public company now. We went public, I guess, a little over 3 months ago, and we're excited to be back in the markets. We feel, you know, it's a great opportunity. You know, for investors, and maybe we're biased, but, you know, when I look at, you know, the ability to build this business, the space that we have, the opportunities that we have to keep growing, the cash flow that we generate, you know, it's hard to look in the retail space, I think, and see something that, you know, is potentially as attractive as this. This retail is very different than other retail, and I'm an old guy, so I've worked in a lot of different places in different countries and different models. But this is really an enthusiast. You know, this is not, you know, someone asked, you know, really people aren't errand shopping. This is people's kind of Disneyland and happy place if you're in this space. Our dwell times are very high, but in our you know, like our Polaris refresh, for example, exceeds 80 minutes on average per customer. Now, you think about someone spending more than 80 minutes for five items that, you know, average $3 to $4 each, and you kind of know what you have to know. And that's the beautiful thing, too, about this business, I would just say before I stop talking, is that, you know, the retail experience matters. And, in fact, I don't think you can be successful in this space in a meaningful way at all, and especially as an online solo, you know, player, if you don't have retail. It's the best analogy we can give you is that we behave very much like a hardware store. It's project-based, componentry, tactile, want to see it, feel it, touch it, extremely SKU-intensive. People like to get help. And for people that are into that, you know, they love it when they can carve out a couple hours at the hardware store. It's the place, you know, where I go when I'm able to, you know, get time away from my kids and not feel guilty about it, because I like to engage in a lot of those activities as well. But, you know, being able to have the interplay, being able to have massive SKU assortments that actually, you know, support your stores and that you can incrementally service very well, being able to, you know, use stores for fulfillment when it makes sense, do curbside and BOPUS as well when that makes sense, and put it all together is what makes the model very special. Even though online is growing, you know, we really don't have many online-only customers, and most of those live too far away from a Joann to go there. But the customers bounce around and ping around back and forth across the channels for a variety of reasons and a variety of different categories that we can explain. But it really is something that really reinforces itself. And with that, I will open it up or give it back to Liz, I guess.
Great. Yeah, thanks. So you touched on a couple topics that I want to dive into a little bit deeper. One is just about, you know, the environment during the pandemic and some of the ways that you had to adapt the business and pivot to this changing demand landscape. So what was, you know, where were you able to source, how did you have to change where you sourced product, you know, how you approached the ways in which the customer wanted to shop, like what were some of the biggest changes that you had to make right away, and then how did that evolve over the course of the last year?
Yeah, that's a great question, and maybe Matt will add some too, but every day was a new rodeo. And, you know, starting in March in the pandemic, you know, the lead team here, we pretty much didn't leave this room. We'd often say that we were actually, you know, quarantining, you know, together and going home and masking up with our families. And we were solving problems with the broader organization, you know, in real time every day. But, you know, at first we said we believed we were essential and we were going to fight to stay open, even though many governments and local areas were saying we had to close. We believe we were essential because from day one we said, you know, masks are going to matter. A third of our business is for charity. Another, you know, 25 or 30% is for people who run small businesses from their kitchen. So this is going to be important. And, you know, many of us in the lead team and others, you know, were daily phones with governors and health officials and others every single day fighting that fight. At one point, we had 400 stores that were closed to the public, but we could do curbside. We didn't have a curbside option. We had a strong BOPUS option, not curbside over a weekend. You know, people worked through the night for 2 days to stand that up. That now has become the best in class in retail with an over, you know, 80 net promoter score, which is unheard of, and a less than 2 minute average wait time per customer. But it started over a night. We also said then that, you know, that we believed we were essential, but that we had more PPE material than anybody in the world, given all the elastic and fabric that we had. And we said we would give away enough to make 15 masks for any person who ever showed up our door and requested it. We gave away, you know, many tens of millions. Our customers gave it away another couple hundred million. I think we ended at about 350 million combined, you know, of cloth masks in the market. That was a, you know, a huge early spike. But, you know, in terms of our business, that, you know, that it all faded by, you know, October, November, when the whole world was selling masks. But early on, these materials weren't available, and being able to do that to give priority to hospitals for medical grade was something that was very important. The supply chains were, you know, crazy. We had, you know, many of our providers that either had shut factories or we were unable to, you know, to move product. We spent an enormous amount of money on air freight. Especially on key items, we did many, many creative things every day to keep product moving because we basically took a stand that, you know, that we needed to make sure that we were on stock no matter what, no matter how, for customers to win the day. You know, while initially a lot of what was happening was kind of like the PPE craze, what really happened, which has really transformed things, is what's happened on the whole house. Especially the arts and crafts and seasonal business. You know, if I go back, you know, 5-6 years ago, you know, we were in those businesses, but I don't think we were standing very tall. We brought in our chief merchant then who initially focused just on arts and crafts. Over 3 years, he brought in tremendous talent and dramatically raised our assortments, our innovation, our quality. And by the way, 60% of everything we sell is really, it can't be a cross shop because it's our own brand or our own designs, et cetera. But really raised our game. And while we were starting to grow there and grow some share, we really weren't getting, you know, our due. And in fact, if just our sewing customer gave us their fair share of basket and arts and crafts and seasonal, we estimated historically that would be about a $200 to $300 million sales increase. But even they weren't even giving us just their, you know, their fair share. I'm not saying all their business, their fair share. And what happened with the pandemic is when people started coming in, you know, for sewing and then, you know, ultimately looking for arts and crafts, it was as if, you know, they almost had a scotoma, I like to say. You know, it's like my wife will say, hey, pass me the salt, and I say, there is no salt. She says, it's right in front of me. I go, I don't see it, right? She says, right, it's right there, because my mind won't let me see it. I think, you know, our customer wasn't able to see the changes we had made there. But all of a sudden, we saw a flood of current customers moving over into our arts and crafts, and a ton of new customers moving into both sewing and moving into arts and crafts. And, you know, the feedback that we get and have gotten is, my gosh, you know, in many cases when we have our broadest assortment range, you know, we, you know, often are seen as having maybe even the best assortments in the industry. And, in fact, you know, someone who had before we did some internal survey work, but when you ask them, you know, how likely would you be to go to Joann and get arts and crafts, we would score about a 30 in the arts and crafts versus our competitors who would score 60, 70-ish on our survey. And if it had been then during that period of Joann just once, we moved up in the 70s, in some cases the 80s. So it was that really unlocked a ton for us. And so anyway, to make to kind of line us a little bit, as we went through the year, we were really able to drive, you know, the business from being more sewing-centric to really exploding arts and crafts and seasonal in a really exciting way. But sewing isn't done yet either. You know, sewing, you know, sounds boring, and that's probably good because we want to be the king or queen of a vibrant niche. But sewing is, you know, is growing nicely, and in fact, 70% of all the growth of machines is in the 30 and under, where that's just exploding. And they're learning on YouTube, they're sharing on Instagram interest, they're, you know, they're also doing, you know, lots of cosplay, lots of, you know, adaptation, upcycling, lots of, you know, household decorating and the like. And it's, you know, it's definitely, you know, hip again. But to your, I guess, to come back to it, Liz, I guess I would say that every day was like surfing a wave, right? And we meet every morning, then we go work, we come back and meet every night. We did that, you know, every day of the week, pretty much all through it. You know, is our supply chain working? Are we working with local officials? Are our customers and employees safe? We, you know, we said on day one when the pandemic hit, we give away PPE to anybody who wanted for free. We said we're not going to furlough a single employee in the company. If you're hourly, you'll get a $2 premium until you're vaccinated, more or less. You know, and, you know, but we need you to stay with us and be a true believer. It was a very defining year in terms of balance sheet, income statement, but more importantly, to go from 60 to 70 million customers in database, 12 to 18 million active email users, to see a whole new tier of customers, which are now, you know, outpacing our best customers before, 12 million apps and growing, and an online business which has exploded multifold and still has, you know, its best days ahead of us, you know, was exciting, but it did require keeping our employees engaged, keeping our, you know, stakeholders and communities happy, keeping our product in stock, keeping our customers safe, you know, investing, you know, wherever we had to invest to kind of surf that wave. And I think we're all pretty proud that it wasn't just an industry that rose, it did, but we gained a lot of new customers and gained a lot of market share, and a lot of that is here to stay.
Right. Yeah, that actually that leads me into my next question nicely, which is just about, as you think about the demand environment today, you know, and everything that's changed over the last, you know, year, you know, 3 months, what gives you the confidence that the individuals that got into crafting or sewing in 2020 will remain engaged in the category now that they can actually, you know, get out of the house and do other things?
Yeah, there's a lot of things about that. And one of the most important things that we look to is kind of what, you know, the two-year stack. The 1 year is lumpy. Last year, our first quarter was down 2, and it was a really wonky quarter. So our stores were closed and not closed, et cetera. Second quarter was up, you know, 53, and that's when you had a lot of PPE, and then Hobby Lobby closed for like 6 or 7 weeks. Then we were like a 26, then I think a 23. You know, as we came into last quarter, which we just announced, you know, the dust is almost completely settled. We were about, I think, a 15 count, maybe 13, 14 on a two-year. And as we look at that, you know, one is the dust is almost settled because, you know, the world is opening up. We're way past PPE and those things. But we also look in our internal business, and, you know, our strongest internal business right now on a two-year stack is the Southeast, which is the most open. And even that, which is the strongest business, still is not fully recovered in some of our really large businesses, which require big parties. So we're really big in proms and weddings and quinceañeras and cosplay events and can go on and on and on. Those businesses are very big for us. Those businesses are, you know, are all coming back in the Southeast, coming back quickly, but still everywhere is hampered. So we say, like, that looks very, very good. You know, the second thing is we look at customer tiers every day, and these new customers are still coming with us. They're coming about, you know, 6 times per year, and that cadence seems to keep going. But we also last year sold an unprecedented number of sewing machines and Cricut machines. You know, and these are people that are engaging in, you know, a variety of activities, including make to sell. That has not slowed up, even though mass making ended in, you know, November. And importantly, we measure these customers and look at their baskets. If you buy a Cricut machine with us or a sewing machine historically, you'll spend $500 with us on each of those. It's ironically close. And then the first year and $300 the second year after that purchase. We keep measuring that. We measured that 2 days ago again. And for the past year and for the past 6 months, that's pretty much more or less one is a little higher, one is a little lower, but they average out to exactly those ratios. What customers have told us, and I think it makes sense, is they said, you know, the reason I never learned to knit or to sew or to whatever is because I never had the time to learn. But what they told us now is, you know, that now that I've learned, I plan to keep doing it, even as other activities arise. And I think that's the exciting thing. You know, sewing is, in particular, like a dumbbell, you know, or a barbell or whatever effect, where the plus 50 market is very vibrant, has been. When people buy a new machine, it's usually a trade-up, but they're actively engaging. Between like 50 and 35, 33, the market is substantially lower. And that's kind of like around the time that Homek got killed and people said, hey, you know, I can get ready to wear stuff anywhere and this or that. But the below 30 market is exploding. And it's exploding for a lot of reasons. You know, one is they're learning how to do it on YouTube and other sources, even in the absence of formal training. But it's also because, you know, they want to be, you know, they want to customize and personalize things. They want to, you know, be able to share on social media and show off. And like I said, in a good way, like I said, they want to, there's a very charitable mindset, too, about giving away. But the rise of the individual maker and what the sewing machine does and the Cricut machine does, to take kind of commercial technology, put it on your kitchen table and let you do commercial grade products for sale, and have a worldwide audience, is a growing phenomenon. I don't see any end in that in sight. And in fact, you know, as that happens more and more outside the U.S., through our Omni, we'll be able to follow the sun on that too.
Right. Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. This is probably the most near-term question I'm going to give you, and then I promise we'll move on to longer-term stuff. But we have heard some questions about, you know, particularly the next quarter, 2Q, and what that looks like in terms of same-store sales growth, just given the volatility and the comparisons. I mean, as we think about this on a two-year growth rate, is there any reason to believe that that shouldn't remain stable with, you know, the last quarter or two?
I mean, we see that, you know, that teens, mid-teens, whatever, kind of bouncing in there for the balance of the year is where we ought to be on that two-year stack basis for comp. You know, we've actually, the margin is, you know, in the first quarter, the margin really was super robust. It's a great environment. And so, you know, we kind of outpaced our own expectations there. That structural margin will continue, we think, through balance of the year and even beyond, with the one caveat that we are seeing enormous upcharges in ocean freight right now. Up to 10 times what we've, you know, historically paid. But we're doing everything we do to keep the product flowing. That, too, will pass. But I say that because I think those, you know, you're going to see those strong top-line two-year stack margins, the strong margin, maybe exceeding our expectation, but for the ocean freight, which will eat some of that goodness, but that ultimately will normalize, and likely not till the end of the calendar year. But having said that, you know, that becomes a tailwind for future periods.
Right. All right, that's it for my questions on 2Q, I promise. So just kind of going to some of your customers / competitors, how we should think about selling platforms like Etsy. I mean, how do retailers like Joanne or your competitors benefit from this network of artisans? But at the same time, do you think that there's a risk that Etsy could potentially compete as a retail platform for things like fabrics and decor and general arts and crafts?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. We see those as completely harmonious. It's kind of the yin and yang model. The more those platforms grow, you know, this has been a year or two since we did the analysis, and it's hard to do because, you know, everything is, you know, not public data. You have to make assumptions and do surveys and interviews. But last time we did it, we were perhaps the number one provider of component parts to Etsy makers, and certainly, you know, on top of the heap in our space. And it's because of that competitive advantage we have, I said, is not just that we're in the, you know, the sewing side of the business, but it's the breadth of our mediums. So, you know, oftentimes things we call sewing is, you know, going to be corkboard or AstroTurf or Mylar or whiteboard or, you know, and velvet and on and on and on, right? And people use cotton for crafting, too, on the other side of the house. But the componentry that we, the plus 200,000 SKUs, the 60%, you know, differentiated you can't get elsewhere, these are creative people that are looking at the broadest possible spectrum to figure out what and how they want to, you know, create and what they can sell it for. So that's very harmonious, and it's really a competitive advantage for us. I would say, you know, Etsy just purchased a, you know, I mean, I'm not in their boardroom, so I can't say specifically, but you saw they just did a fairly large acquisition of really what I would call a, you know, a horizontal space. So, you know, another platform of make to sell, or, you know, selling goods in really kind of a almost Gen Z space. And I think that makes sense for them, because the other way you could go is to vertically integrate in product. But I would tell you that, you know, you cannot, you know, just go out and source a couple thousand products and beam ideas into these people's heads. It's the breadth of SKU, the own brand, the assortment that wins the day. If you don't, you know, we can make it work because our supply chains are fulfilling our stores, and then we can allow that assortment in a variety of ways to customers. But if you were just going to go build a warehouse and fill it full of a bunch of SKUs and hope that customers come and buy it without having a store base to fill it, I think it ends in disaster. You know? And in fact, that's why the online pure plays in our space are less than 10% combined, and they always have been. You just, when these items cost $2 or $3 or $4 for a customer, and you need 6 or 7 of them, and you want to go for a pool of, you know, hundreds of thousands, and you need some of that tactile nature too. You know, if that's not your core business of doing that to fill stores, you could never make it work just as a pure play only. There's just no margin there, and you're making bets that if, you know, unless you can predict what everybody's going to want, it's not going to work out well.
Yeah, no, that makes a ton of sense. And I mean, what are, I guess, how did people used to make to sell, like before there were platforms like this available? I mean, what was the traditional selling method if that was your business?
So that's a great question. You know, our chief merchant, Rob Will, who's really fabulous, you know, he likes to tell the story, and it's just so true, right? His mother, and actually my sister-in-law and my mother, right, you know, makes to sell items. So she would make, you know, her yarn rabbits for Christmas and other things, right? And then you go to there'll be a craft fair, and you go out and you set up a card table, and she's actually kind of an introvert, right? So then you stand there in the rain, you know, and, you know, all day long, and, you know, talk to some people, even may be uncomfortable, and, you know, you sell 3 or 4 items and feel good about that and go home, right? But now, of course, in Etsy, where you've got, you know, 4 million makers and 70 million eyeballs, and there's many other platforms too, I just use Etsy as an example, you know, all of a sudden, you know, you've got, you know, the eyeballs of the world at you, and you're able to get scale on what you do, and you don't have to, you know, make those cumbersome journeys for very little money. But what's key for us, though, is in that componentry, is the way we do high-low and the way we do other offers is, you know, it really allows makers who make the sell to hit the price points they need so their economic model works. You know, it doesn't sound like a lot, but if our you know, high-low sales don't hit a certain sweet spot, they go from, you know, making it and selling it for $10 and making $5 to only making $2, and it's not worth their time, and they don't show up. But when we make those models work across all the things that we do with our offers, you know, you see huge moves in volume. It's kind of like I like to say, it's like my pizza guy used to complain, and Matt's did too, about rising cost of mozzarella, because they couldn't make any money on pizza. And it's the same thing in our industry, and it's the same thing across so many thousands of SKUs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, then they have to just start using less and less mozzarella, and who wants that kind of pizza?
Yeah, right. You know, that's exactly right.
Actually, that's a great shift into cost, which is where I wanted to go next. Just, you know, what are the commodities that Joann is most exposed to, and how should we think about your sensitivity to earnings around commodity costs?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I'll talk a little, and then Matt can always, you know, build on it. You know, first and foremost, you know, if you ask me what keeps me up at night, it's like, you know, potential runaway inflation. And I think it shouldn't be just Joann. It should be a lot of companies if that happens. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it just kind of tells you the order of, you know, we think that the markets and the customers will be more vibrant. But that's always a concern. And within that, you know, obviously we're exposed to, you know, feedstocks, you know, oil and paper and things like others would be. But for me, probably what tops the list would be if there was a real systemic shock in the dollar. Because, you know, 50% of what we buy or 60% is from China, and then we source a lot of other countries. But, you know, if you had a shock in the dollar in a way for us, that becomes kind of a, you know, an inflationary threat, even if domestic inflation isn't high. Now, on the other hand, if you see domestic inflation in wages and other things, but you don't see that kind of inflation in some of the countries Turkey and others we source from, that actually allows us to hedge it versus, you know, domestic inflation. But But they do have feedstocks like oil and other things. And so to the extent that those would get shocked and there'd be a dollar movement, you know, that would be something that, you know, we have to manage. We do have pretty good pricing power here. And we do have, especially on the depth of promotion and other things, ways that we can get pricing on a net price basis out. But, you know, I think it's tougher for everyone if we live in a world where consumers are seeing inflation for all angles. So they have, you know, less to spend in aggregate. And then, you know, if our stuff becomes more expensive, we've been able to actually, over the last year or so, actually reduce prices while getting a better margin. So reduce, you know, shelf pricing, be smarter on promotions, still play the high-low game, but get more in our pocket and have our customers feel even better about our price perception. So we do that. We manage that. Again, right now, really the 90% of the issue we're seeing right now is in transportation, and 80% of that we're seeing that as ocean freight. That's driven by a lack of containers and a lack of large vessels. I'm sure you're hearing that from every retailer, but this too will pass. And so, you know, this time next year, we'll probably be talking about that as, you know, a tailwind, but hopefully we're not talking about, you know, lots of other costs as a headwind.
Right, yeah. And we've seen supply chain issues, constraints across all of hardline retail. You know, another topic that's come up was, you know, labor shortages for particularly hourly employees. Are you seeing any of that on just in terms of store level or distribution center staffing? Are you finding it difficult to find enough people, in other words?
We see it everywhere. I mean, you just drive around and you see a help wanted everywhere and talk to others and we hear it everywhere. We're actually pretty lucky. I would say we really have not had that issue with hourlies, and I'll tell you why. I think on day one when we said we weren't furloughing anybody, and we didn't, and then we gave premiums, we've been able to keep our full-time and part-time employees 100% employed. And so they're still with us. Where I see it, where people are really struggling, is where they, you know, did a furlough or lay off employees, and now they're trying to get them back, and they just don't want to come back for a variety of different reasons. We also have really, I feel, in my 5 years here, I feel we've never been in a better spot in terms of, you know, the fairness of wages that we, you know, pay. You know, I think when I came, our average DC wage was just over $11. Right now, it's, you know, over 17. We do gain sharing where they can earn more, but actually it pays for itself because our turnover has dropped and they're more productive. So, you know, it doesn't cost us any net more. We can go to sleep at night knowing that we're not 90% turnover, training new people who leave before they're even trained. Same in the stores, you know, both our full-time and our part-time. We've taken up, you know, a couple fold, several fold of what inflation has been the past few years, and we feel we're in a good competitive spot there too. But it's not, you know, I guess a sort of Damocles over our head of either, you know, local increases per se or just a pressure to keep people. We do have, you know, the vast majority of our store employees are part-timers. They work at Joann because they love to sew, they love to craft, they love to share. They don't want to maybe work 40 hours a week. We give them very, very big discounts on products so they can fuel their passion. This is actually a point of differentiation in every survey we've done, that our employees are the most knowledgeable and helpful in the industry. And it really is because, you know, this is what they love to do, and be able to work 20 hours a week, earn some money, get big discounts on what we do, and be able to talk to customers is the thing that gives them juice.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I guess this may be sort of related, just kind of talking about how your stores are transforming and, you know, that the people that you hire are a big part of that. Can you just walk us through the store reformatting initiative and how many stores you're doing per year and what the major changes are, and so how we can think about what the potential upside to sales is on those stores that have been renovated?
Yeah, I'll frame it and then I'll let Matt take it kind of a little bit deeper, but you know, our stores are kind of snowflakes. They go from 7,000 to 55,000 square feet. About a third of our chain are kind of, you know, that 30,000 plus, so pretty large stores. We got to snowflakes because over time we did, so, you know, M&A. And the smaller ones are going to be much more sewing centric. So the bigger we go, then, you know, probably at around 25,000 square feet, it starts to balance out. And then we grow arts and crafts seasonal even more. And then we grow experience on top of that. You know, so that's kind of the frame of reference. Unlike any retailer I've worked with or for before, you know, as we increase the size of our stores, we increase the sales per square foot on average, which is, you know, it doesn't feel sensical until you kind of understand that When you get to, mid-20s and up, we're able to provide not only the best overall sewing assortment, we're able to get to our best overall assortment as we approach that 30,000, where we also have all of our arts and crafts and we have all of our seasonal decor. That broad assortment brings in, not only does it please our core customer where they give us more share of wallet on other items, it actually brings in a whole new consideration set of customers. Because now, it's especially when you have experience, it's very difficult for anybody to pack a punch like we can punch across the broad spectrum. That's a really exciting thing for us. The more we make the change and the more competition we have in an area, even the better, because there's more business to get because it's so differentiated. But we're on a journey to refresh the whole chain. That doesn't just mean, size of store and assortment. It also means in the things we're doing to change the game in service, and also just in terms of the overall experience, where if you went to some of our prototypes, of which we have 30 or so, and you were experienced, the best of what we have to offer, you would see that we've completely stepped out of the traditional arts and crafts chain. An enthusiast space where this is people's Disneyland, and now we provided something which they've never seen before, and they truly value. So let maybe Matt walk through the journey for the economics and some other thoughts on that.
Sure. Thanks, Wade. Yeah, we've actually just completed a very thorough analysis and kind of put together all of our learnings around 30 stores we've already done and been able to kind of read results. And really excited about that. One of the things we've kind of opened our eyes to is we have a lot more opportunity to relocate stores and right-size stores than we even thought going in. We think about roughly a third of the chain would benefit substantially. These are going to be our highest lifts in terms of top-line opportunity by relocating those stores within market, typically to much larger stores, nearly always to better quality real estate with better quality co-tenancy. So we're aggressively going after those situations. We would hope to do 20 to 30 of those per year. They somewhat get tied to when their leases end. We would fill out the balance, which we think we'll do about 60 to 70 projects a year with more in-situ opportunities. So these are stores we could improve. We're happy with the location they're in. They're the right size. They're in good quality centers. We like the co-tenancy that we have. Really, the opportunities in these stores is macro assortment. So this is an opportunity we have to go and relay the entire store. Historically, we've only kind of optimized within certain assortments. So if Fine Art had 80 feet, it's probably had that 80 feet for a while. Well, in doing our analysis, in a lot of cases, we'll find Fine Arts maybe should be much larger, baking should be a little smaller, jewelry should also grow. You can see with all the different categories we have, there's just a lot of value to unlock by getting that right. So you can do nothing but get that right, do some branding and refresh work. That project will cost about $200,000 to $250,000, and we've consistently seen 5 to 10% lifts from doing nothing but that. Then we'll have other stores where we would do a bit more than that. These are typically larger stores, in some case a bit older stores that just need more attention, but they're very highly profitable stores. All but a handful of our stores are net cash flow positive, but these are a little more so. We may be investing $400,000 to $600,000 in these stores, potentially getting some landlord contribution to help offset those costs. But typically looking for a 10% or more lift where we do that. And then we would also have a set of stores. Best examples of this, if you looked at our store at Polaris Parkway in Columbus, we have two of them on the West Coast in Sherman Oaks and Torrance in the L.A. market, and we're completing one at Paramus, New Jersey. Currently, that'll be done this summer. These are more of what we consider our flagship experience. Would have all the experiential elements, technology, services, a creator studio in the middle of the store with equipment you can rent and additional services that we provide, additional marketing collateral in the store. Really our best shot. These projects are $2 million and up in some cases, almost always partially supported by landlord contribution to that. And we would be typically expecting 20% or higher lifts in those locations. So if you kind of balance all of that out with all the pre-opening costs, over the next 7 to 10 years, looking to spend somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 to $600 million on this, and that would, with the lifts we get and the fact that we flow through about 40% of our sales gains in an average store to the bottom line, would look in a blended payback of about 4 years per average project. So certainly excited. I think on top of the financial wins, we feel it's just an opportunity for us to kind of remake this industry from a physical plant perspective and a location perspective, and really just kind of change the game in terms of what a customer should expect from a retailer in our space in terms of the experience they get when they walk through the door.
Perfect. And so transitioning a bit from brick and mortar to online, I'm just curious what's been working well with the online strategy. Does it start to get difficult to sell fabric online just given the tactile nature of the product, or has the consumer become much more receptive as they have in a number of other categories where we wouldn't have thought that online would work as well, but that has really kind of, you know, taken off in recent months/years?
Yeah, I mean, online business has grown, you know, dramatically, as I said, and it's now about 15% penetration. But we kind of see that it's not a separate channel. It's really part of that holistic experience, never giving customers a reason to say no. You know, what's working great in there is I think 40% of our business on a daily, you know, basis of the online business is actually buy online, pick up in store, or curbside. Customers love our curbside option. It's best in class now, but also, you know, and the logic is different for every category, but a lot of reasons that that's offered is because, for example, we'll launch a new Cricut machine, and people will say, man, I want to be first in the queue, so they'll secure it. But then they'll come to the store, and they'll finish all their Cricut rolls and all their other purchases. So it's making sure they can get the one item that they have, or they have a project, and they know that there's one particular item that's hard to get, and they don't want to make a trip if it's not there and they can't, you know, absolutely secure it. You know, there's other I give you so many different examples, but, you know, we carry – thousands and thousands of, you know, yarn skeins, but you might want to do a project that takes 12 or 15 skeins of the same color. You want to come to the store, see it, touch it, feel it, but you know that it's probably unlikely for anyone will have 15, and you want the same dye lot. So you might, now that you've seen it, you want to place an online order to make sure that they're absolutely identical, you know, when you're beginning to knit. And it goes, you know, on and on like that. We also have, you know, of our plus, our power makers, people that are buying 10,000 yards for speaker covers, you know, or they do speaker room, you know, custom fits where they, you know, do soundproofing, or, you know, they're running other small businesses, you know, frocks for the Catholic Church where they buy tens of thousands of certain kinds of product. You know, they'll want to come and see and touch it and feel it, and then they'll call us and say, hey, can I get, you know, 1,000 yards of this and 2,000 yards of that now that I know what it is. But it's a really iterative process. Again, I think the best analogy for our stores is like a hardware store. They do like to see it, touch it, feel it, et cetera, but in some ways they'll use the store as a showcase model if they have other, you know, quantity or types of requirements. But, you know, fabric itself would not be, you know, one of our highest online penetrations, actually. We have other categories that are several-fold higher, including, you know, machines and, you know, and other crafting categories. So it still is more tactile than others. But, you know, Liz, to your point, you know, as we grow online, you know, where we're leaving a lot of money on the table, last year we had to walk away from almost $100 million in business because the demand was so crazy, and we were filling almost everything from stores, so we had to walk away from some line fill orders. Our central fill capability is going to be able to, you know, capture, you know, most of that opportunity and get us, you know, in the high 90s. We also last year had 40% of our online orders that had, you know, multiple ships per order because, you know, one particular location didn't have all of it. So when you think about paying an extra $7 on, you know, last year, which was, I don't know, 10 million, is that right? Maybe 10, 12 million orders, 40% of that, that's a big number. And that central capability that we're putting in is also going to be able to help us do that because the algorithms will first, you know, route it to a point where it can be 100% fulfilled before it forces, you know, any split. So we have, you know, both top-line opportunity by filling the gap of lost line fill. We have top-line by extending the tail. You're going to see, you know, more and more as we tier up across various parts, fabric and other parts of our business. That will be smarter to do online. We can do some swatching in stores but not carrying that inventory everywhere. and the big cost driver we have, because outside of that, our economics are almost parity across channels, is being able to really reduce, you know, multi shifts for any given order.
Great. And I want to pivot quickly to, you know, just something that we've been really focused on at B of A, which is ESG initiatives. And, you know, we launched last year our ESG meter for the consumer discretionary space. And so I was curious about what some of Joanne's top initiatives are for sustainability, environmental awareness, and how you're leading the arts and crafts retail space in the area of ESG.
You know, we've always been mission and purpose driven, and, you know, I think it's in terms of how we treat our employees, how we've embraced diversity, equity, inclusion, and continue to do so, and how we've also been very charitable to our own causes, but also to our customer causes. But, you know, there's an opportunity to take this to a whole new level. What we're working on now and launching is kind of our version of ESG, and, you know, kind of the long and short of it is that, you know, as a company, we green is our color. It's our color and our brand, but it's also what we call our color and our color and our culture. So when we're green as a culture, you know, we're a meritocracy of ideas. We don't build silos. We don't play turf. The customer comes first. The business interests are always more important than our own. And we really live that every day, and we reward that, and we excise it when we don't get that. Our version of ESG, is what we're working and launching, is what we call evergreen. So it's being, you know, green in a way that will sustain the company into the future on the platforms you mentioned. So, you know, within that, we talk about kind of like TLC. We need a lot of TLC to be evergreen. So, you know, the T is, you know, our team members really mattering, making sure we're paying fair wages, making sure we're embracing, you know, diversity and equity and inclusion in what we do, and making sure that we're really a place that inspires and takes care and is fair for all of our employees to bring their best game to work every day. And so we've got a series of initiatives in that. You know, L, you know, is really our love of the earth. So what are we doing, you know, to consume as little energy as possible? You know, LEDs, solar, those things. What are we doing for sustainable packaging? What are we doing to make sure product doesn't end up in dumpsters? What are we doing to make sure that the products that we sell are, you know, environmentally conscious, to make sure that our vendors and our ecosystems are also being good citizens? We have multiple initiatives there. And that last C is really, you know, caring for the, you know, the communities that our customers and our employees, for that matter, live and work in. So a variety of causes. You know, we work with so many charities, you know, across a variety of spectrums. You know, again, 30% of what our customers make, they make to give away to charities. So, you know, Project Lioness, millions of blankets for children in hospitals. There's many, many guilds that work for, you know, support cancer victims, that support shelter pets, homeless. You know, we're raising right now, as we speak, several hundred thousand dollars in our stores for the Nationwide Children's Hospital, which is the On Our Sleeves campaign for teenagers who are depressed and suicidal in some cases, and helping their mental well-being, which is more important now than COVID. But, you know, a big plank for this is supporting those charities that we believe are right on in par with who we are, but also aligning some of those funds and money, you know, such as our Black Maker grants, where we've given, you know, many multiple $1,000 grants away, and thousands of others have received, you know, various levels of support from us to help enable their small businesses. But we really see that when it comes to this pillar, that the interests of Joanne and our customers have to be totally aligned, and that, you know, if they support it and it's worthy, we want to support them. You know, the mask making is a good example, right? We're working with our customers. Our giveaways in there has exceeded 300 million masks in a, you know, a four-month period of time. But we really feel that when we support, you know, not only our causes, but the causes of our customers and the communities in which they work and live and across the country, that this is just a reinforcing loop and one more reason why, you know, Joanne should be their go-to.
Great. So I want to make sure that the audience has time to ask any questions if they have any. And so, Christy, if you could just let everybody know how they can get in the queue to ask a question, we'll see if there are any on the line.
Certainly. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star followed by the number one on your telephone keypad. If you're calling from a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off to ensure your signal can reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open, and you may state your name before posing your question. Again, star one, and I'll pause for just a moment to give everyone a chance to signal. Again, star one to ask a question. And we have no questions in the queue at this time.
Great. Then I think I will just ask one more to kind of wrap it up. What are the opportunities that you're most excited about, just transforming JOANN into its next phase of development and where you can take this company for the next 3 to 5 years?
Super excited about the core. I mean, I think we've got, you know, a wonderful opportunity in a thriving market with a lot of opportunities and things like the refresh. When we put the best version of ourselves forward and we see the not only the expression on our customers' faces, but the fact that they're voting with their feet and their wallets, that's very exciting. But also, I'd say that we've got, you know, kind of, you know, four major blue ocean opportunities we're working on top of the core over time. A couple were referenced in the prospectus, but these are opportunities that we think are going to use the assets we have, not put a lot of bricks and mortar down, but really extend our reach into very big and profitable pools in a world which is, you know, especially on the sewing side of the house, it's a world where people are sewing everywhere. You know, most of the sewers are outside the U.S., 90-95%, even 70% of the machine sales. And yet there's no one real JOANN out there that has our breadth of assortments and products, differentiated items, and we know that there's a big calling for it. We also have assets that, you know, digitally have, you know, a lot of value that can go a lot further than they have. So that's exciting, too. But, you know, I look forward to talking to those as they, you know, give birth. We've been working those for many years. But I hesitate to share too much on those, too, because for us, nothing's going to distract us from making sure that the core delivers on what we know it's capable of, so that those things are gravy on top, if you will, or just a cherry on top of the overall proposition.
Great. Well, thank you both so much for joining us today. We really appreciate the time. And so if anyone has any follow-up questions for me, feel free to shoot me an email at elizabeth.suzuki@bofa.com. Thank you so much, guys, from JOANN. We really appreciate it.
Thank you all for the generous listening.
Yeah, thank you.
And that does conclude our call for today. Thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect.